welcome to the Science Podcast for September 5th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, how the brain organizes memory in the hippocampus. New estimates about how high the sea may rise by the year 2100, and examining psychopathic criminals. All of this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Suppose each time you came to an intersection, you had to turn left or right, depending on how you had turned the last time. Turn right if you turned left last time, and turn left if you turned right last time. Now, in between each turn and remembering which way to go, you also have to run on a treadmill for 20 seconds. Okay, so it's not a terribly challenging task, even for a rat. But the point of the experiment in rats was to measure what the brain's hippocampus is doing while in the maze and on the treadmill. And in a paper in this week's Science, Yuri Bezhaki and colleagues report that based on their measurements of neural signals in the rat's hippocampus, they could predict whether the rat was going to make a left or right turn. The work provides new insights into how the brain organizes memory, which in turn guides behavior. I spoke with Bezhaki from his office at Rutgers University in New Jersey.
We all imagine that when there is no input coming to the brain, then the brain itself generates a sequence of neural activity that somehow guides behavior. For example, if I ask you a question about some high school experience, you can tell me a one-minute summary, or you can give me a five-hour story, and during this time, everything, all this information that comes out from your brain is due to the self-organized activity of the brain. It has nothing to do with what happens in the outside world. It may, but if the outside world stays constant, your brain is still generating these evolving assemblies. And this is exactly the mechanism that we found in rodents. The message is that even a simple brain, red brain, is capable of generating self-organized activity. And this self-organized activity reflects either past or future behavior, and it doesn't require any online interaction with the environment.
What did you train the rats to do?
Of course, our main goal is to understand how these self-organized activities guide cognitive behavior. But because we cannot interact with animals verbally, we had to design experiments where we can indirectly make such an inference. So the experimental design is very simple. It's a memory experiment where the goal of the animal is to remember the previous choice. For example, when in a T-maze it made a right turn, that based on this past right turn, it has to plan the future choice, which will be the left turn. It's an alternation task. The trick component that we introduced in this standard task is that there is a delay, and between the choices, the animal is required to run in a running wheel for 20 seconds. Now, we train the animals to run always in the same direction and at steady speed for 20 seconds. The goal of this manipulation was that the environmental signals that reach the animal remain the same throughout the delay period, as well as the so-called idiothetic or body signals that come from muscles, joints, and the skin also remain steady.
Because it's in the running wheel.
Because it's in the running wheel. So just imagine yourself running in a wheel or in a treadmill, then the world is as constant as it's possible, as well as the inputs from your body is also very constant. So as far as we could control, everything is steady. Now, the interesting thing for us, of course, was that what happens in the brain, namely the hippocampal part of the brain, where the information about the past choice and the future plan, or the plan of the future running trajectory, is supposedly stored.
And how did you measure that in the rat while it was in the maze and in the wheel?
Most of the information in the brain, including the hippocampus, emerges through interactions among neurons. So the right or the proper tool is to record from a large number of these neurons. And for this purpose, we implanted silicone probes into the hippocampus. So these probes were monitoring individual neurons from close by recording sites. And so we had a couple of dozens to hundreds of neurons that we recorded simultaneously.
And what did you find?
what we found is that neurons, instead of firing in a steady manner or in an erratic manner, or a subset of these recorded neurons, were active for a short period of time, usually about 1 second in the running wheel, after which another set of neurons fired for the same duration, followed by another set and another set and another set. So sequences of neurons or sequences of neural assemblies filled the 20-second delay period. Now, this alone is an interesting finding, but the main interesting finding was is that we could segregate or separate these sequences based on the future choice of the animal. Namely, from trials, when the animal made the right turn, we could collect the information and sort the sequences, that is neuron A followed by B, C, D, E, and F, and so on, and then look whether similar or different sequences occur when the animal will make the left choice.
So neurons in the hippocampus fire in particular patterns depending on the spatial task, the left or right turn?
That's the main finding of our experiment, is that these patterns, you can call them trajectories, that is how the activity from neuron A to Z evolves, or from neuron A to any other neuron or neural assembly evolves, is characteristic of the future choice. In other words, if the animal makes the same choice a couple of times, and we show those trajectories, they are very similar. But if we contrast the left and right trajectories, that is the sequences associated with left and right choices, they are characteristically different. And with a very high precision, in every single trial, we could predict the choice of the animal that was down the line 20 seconds from the time the animal entered the wheel. So 20 seconds ahead, we could tell whether the animal will make a right turn or left turn.
What happens when the animals made errors?
We also found that in most cases, we could predict the error 20 seconds in advance. So, for example, I don't know how you are, but sometimes I'm driving my daughter to school, but I forget about it and I make the turn, a couple of turns towards my workplace. And it's quite clear it's not the environmental signals that are guiding my brain. There is an internal plan. So this internal plan tells the animals to make a left turn or right turn at the moment they enter the wheel.
How many rats did you test?
In the main study, we tested 3 rats, and it may sound like a small number, but the reason why this is respectable is because we individually analyzed each animal as well as recorded from a large number of neurons.
And what kind of variability is there in the patterns between one rat and another?
We show each rat separately, and indeed there are animals that generate patterns that very reliably segregate future left and right turns, and one of the animals, although it was still significant between left and right, it was not so spectacular. And one can speculate only at this point that the animals learn using different strategies or their distractibility is different. Plus, the acquired knowledge by the time we tested the animals was different because not all animals learn with the same speed.
So you were able to tell within each animal what it was about to do.
Exactly.
But not across animals. The patterns in one animal didn't match the patterns.
The patterns are absolutely characteristic of you. So when you recall this conversation tomorrow, the pattern in your hippocampus will be entirely different than in mine. But if you recall it the day after tomorrow, and I will recall this conversation day after tomorrow, then the pattern of neural activity will be similar to day one and day two in your brain and day one and day two in my brain, but our two brains will not be comparable. This is very characteristic to each individual brain.
Is it likely that this same mechanism or these same processes that are happening in the rat's hippocampus are happening in the brains of other animals, perhaps even humans?
Well, that's the beautiful complementary part, namely that we submitted our work together with Itzhak Fried, who has done related experiments in humans, in epileptic patients. And what we predict in this rat experiment is that during learning and perhaps recalling, the same neural sequences are being activated, and I think this is exactly the same kind of conclusion was reached by the investigators studying the human brain.
Yuri Bezhaki, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Yuri Bezhaki is senior author of a paper on internally generated cell assembly sequences in the rat hippocampus. Read the paper in this week's Science and the related paper Bezhaki mentioned on human studies online at www.scienceexpress.org. Also this week, a genetic portrait of the deadliest cancers. Two research teams have identified the genomic alterations that help turn normal cells into two of the deadliest cancers, a common type of brain cancer called glioblastoma multiforme and pancreatic cancer. Both studies revealed that the genomic alterations in these tumors affect a core set of cellular signaling pathways and regulatory processes, which suggests that failure in those processes may lead to the disease. In turn, the research suggests a new way of looking at cancer and developing therapies that target the physiological effects of the altered pathways and processes rather than their individual gene components. Read more about the genomic analyses online at www.scienceexpress.org. The melting of ice caps and glaciers is predicted to raise the sea level substantially over the next 100 years. And having a good estimate of just how much that rise will help in managing coastal areas where the majority of people live. In a paper in this week's Science, Tad Pfeffer and colleagues calculate a range of sea level rise estimates and forecast a sea level rise between 0.8 meters and 2 meters by the year 2100. I spoke with Pfeffer from his office at the University of Colorado, Boulder.
If you want to try to calculate how rapidly glaciers and ice sheets could raise sea level, in a very simple fashion, but one that takes into account the flow of glaciers and rapid flow of ice out through outlet glaciers, draining not only the glaciers of the world, but also the ice sheets, Greenland and Antarctica, you can calculate in a pretty simple way that it would be very difficult for sea level to be raised more than about 2 meters in the next century, just by the limitations on how fast you can move ice. Part of it you can melt and run off as water. And then another part, which has been very controversial, partly because we don't understand it very well, is how rapidly you can move ice through these fast-moving outlet glaciers that we've heard a lot about, particularly in Greenland in the last few years. And if you let those glaciers speed up to quite high velocities, the kind of velocities that we've been seeing in a few of the big Greenland outlet glaciers, you discover that you still can't move ice out terribly quickly. We can accomplish 2 meters of sea level rise total, and that's including thermal expansion.
What is the main difference here between your model, which is at most 2 meters of sea level rise in the next century, and, say, the estimates published by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the latest assessment?
So the IPCC fourth assessment, which gave numbers that were substantially smaller than that, didn't include dynamics.
What do you mean by dynamics?
Dynamics is the part of discharge of ice from glaciers into the ocean, which is accomplished not by melting the ice and letting it run off as water, but by pushing ice as icebergs right out into the ocean. So it's accomplished by the flow of the glacier, or what we call the dynamics, rather than melting of glacier ice on the surface. When the IPCC's fourth assessment was published, they left out dynamics. They were very upfront about it. They said, this is an important process, but we don't understand it well enough to make the kind of consensus statement about dynamics that is, you know, the standard of the IPCC. So they said, since we can't really deal with this in anything resembling a confident fashion, we're going to leave it out. And so as a consequence, the sea level estimates, they were known to be low because that process wasn't taken into account. And since that time, there have been a number of different groups and individuals who've tried to get a handle on what that dynamic contribution might be, how rapidly outlet glaciers might be able to move ice into the ocean by having these outlet glaciers speed up.
How high do those estimates get?
Well,
in the published literature.
In the published literature, you can find estimates as high as 4 to 6 meters of sea level rise at rates occurring at something like 2 to 5 centimeters per year. Now, that's very high sea level rise. It's based on analogies with past conditions, particularly at the last interglacial, when sea levels were at least 4 meters higher and possibly a great deal higher. And those were conditions that were very analogous to what we're coming into today. And in fact, within the next century, we may be in climate conditions that are more or less identical to the last interglacial, 125,000 years ago. But the timing of that sea level rise back then is very uncertain. And that was what our analysis is really about, is the question of, okay, sea level rise may be big, but how fast is it going to occur?
So how would you describe the uncertainty in your team's model?
Well, we publish a range. We present a range of total sea level rise ranging from about 80 centimeters up to 2 meters. And there's a great deal of uncertainty in there, again, because We still don't know the processes, but there are some very simple concepts that you can use to place brackets or bounds, if you like, on what outlet glaciers might do, how rapidly outlet glaciers might deliver ice to the ocean in the future. And the reasonable values fall within about 80 centimeters to 2 meters. That's not to say that it's physically impossible that we could have a total sea level rise of greater than 2 meters in the next century, but to do so would require processes to come into play and things to happen in glacier systems that we've never seen before. It's not impossible, but it's not something that I would recommend that we adopt as a working hypothesis. If we're going to try to make predictions based on our best understanding of glacier physics, it should be based on the range of values and processes that we know best.
Besides learning more about the glacier physics and the dynamics of glacier melt, what other refinements, if any, of this model would improve it further?
Well, the primary thing, the number one thing, really, is understanding glacier physics better, particularly understanding the sliding of glaciers on their bed and the calving of icebergs into the ocean and the interaction between what happens at the front of an ice stream or an outlet glacier where it enters the ocean and the motion of the glacier upstream from that point. Those are things that we've worked on for many years, particularly on small mountain glaciers, but we have not pushed the understanding of those processes far enough to be able to make a quantitative predictive model. So that's one thing. Another thing that we would need to know better is to have a much better idea of the shape, the geometry of outlet glaciers and ice sheets and mountain glaciers, not just Greenland and Antarctica, but all of the glaciers together. And the geometry, the shape that we particularly need is what they look like on their bed. Moving ice into the ocean rapidly by calving of icebergs means that you have some channel which ends in the ocean. The glacier has to terminate in the ocean for this to happen. So we need to know what the subglacial topography looks like. We know that pretty well in Greenland. And for that reason, the analysis that we present in this paper is, the first part of it is really focused on Greenland because we've more or less got the information we need there to do our analysis. If we're going to go to Antarctica or to the other glaciers and ice caps throughout the world, and don't forget that the majority of sea level rise today coming from land ice is coming not from Greenland and Antarctica, but from the aggregate of smaller glaciers and ice caps across the world. They're a very important part of the calculation. But we need to know the geometry of those much better. Some of that information is already in hand and simply has to be categorized and organized in a fashion that we can work with it efficiently. Some of it actually requires further field observations, particularly radar echo sounding to show us what the bed of the glacier looks like, the bedrock surface beneath the ice.
Tad Pfeffer, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Tad Pfeffer is lead author of a paper on the kinematic constraints on outlet glacier response and land ice contributions to 21st century sea level rise. Read the paper in this week's Science. Psychopathic criminals account for an estimated 1/4 of prison populations. Conventional wisdom holds that psychopathy is untreatable, but researchers say the science is lacking, particularly about which cognitive processes and brain regions in psychopaths are dysfunctional. Neurobiologist Kent Keel is working to fill that knowledge gap and is scanning criminals to do it. Science's Greg Miller writes about Keel's work in this week's issue.
So this article is about a researcher, a neuroscientist named Kent Keel in New Mexico, who's doing a fairly unique experiment. He's interested in studying psychopathic criminals and trying to understand their brains and trying to understand if there's something different about their brains that predisposes them to violent crime. And he has permission from the governor of New Mexico to go into all 12 New Mexico state prisons and conduct clinical interviews with the inmates. They're collecting DNA samples. And they're also doing a lot of brain scanning. He has a very sophisticated mobile magnetic resonance imaging scanner that can move from one prison to the next. And they can use that to get anatomical images of the brain and also study neural activity in the brain while the inmates are doing various kinds of tasks.
Why psychopaths in particular?
Well, different studies have found that 20 to 25% or so of the prison population is psychopathic. And psychopathy is kind of a set of personality traits and patterns of behavior. But for whatever reason, these people seem to commit a lot more than their share of crime, and violent crime in particular. So the cost to society is really pretty significant. And we really know very little about the underlying biology or what might be going on that's different in the brains of people with psychopathy.
So it's sort of a cost-benefit analysis.
Yeah, I think that's one way to look at it. And what Kiel told me was that various researchers have estimated that about 1% of the population might actually be psychopathic, which is kind of scary to think about. But that's actually a prevalence pretty similar to schizophrenia. There's millions and millions of dollars poured into schizophrenia research for good reason, but really relatively little put into psychopathy research, which is a little bit disconcerting, I guess, given the greater cost to society caused by the violent crime that these people get involved with. And Kiel told me there's never been, in fact, a randomized controlled clinical trial of any kind for any kind of intervention for psychopathy. And that's part of what he's trying to do something about.
Now, you mentioned functional magnetic resonance imaging scans, the fMRI scans, and a little bit about what he would be looking at. But who's he going to be comparing these scans against?
Right. So because they have access to the prisons, they have access to thousands, many thousands potentially, of convicted criminals. And some of them would qualify as psychopathic and many of them would not. So one comparison, of course, could be between, you know, looking at the criminals who are psychopathic and those who aren't. And then you could also have another control group of college students, which is, you know, kind of the standard group that a lot of control experiments in neuroimaging are done with.
Any likelihood that these scans may be unique, owing to the unique nature of the scanner?
I think there might be some concern among some researchers that because this is a mobile scanner, which is something that other people have used, and some of the researchers I talked to were a little concerned about whether the data that comes out of that would be as good as the typical MRI scanner that you would find in a hospital setting, for example. But Kiel worked for over a year with engineers at Siemens, the company that manufactured it, to hopefully ensure that the magnetic field is stable and to take care of some of those methodological concerns.
So is the overall idea then to lead to better diagnosis or treatment or something else?
Well, I think it could really be both of those things. I mean, I guess the starting point is just that this is something we don't really understand very well. So if we did understand the underlying biology a little bit better, conceivably that could give us a way to make more accurate predictions about the risk to society posed by individual prisoners. I mean, that's kind of a far-off goal that may or may not ever come to pass, but that's one possibility. And then the other, the ultimate goal, I think, for Kiel and other people would be to come up with some sort of intervention that if we understand, you know, if there is something different about the brains of people who are psychopathic and we understand why that comes about, is there a genetic risk factor, are there certain environmental conditions that tend to push people in that direction, maybe we could identify them early on, maybe we could intervene in a way that would prevent them from becoming psychopathic and going on to a life of violent crime.
How are psychopaths diagnosed in the first place?
Well, the standard tool that's used is a checklist that was developed by a Canadian psychologist, and the first edition of it came out almost 30 years ago now. It's called the Psychopathy Checklist, and it's now the revised edition, so it's called the PCLR for Psychopathy Checklist Revised. And it looks at 20 different traits and patterns of behavior, and it scores people on a 40-point scale. Like one of the traits that's common in psychopathic people is shallow affect. They're just sort of emotionally very flat. And so they would get a score from 0, meaning they're not that way at all, to a 2, which would mean they're really that way. And it sort of goes along through these 20 different characteristics and scores them from 0 to 2. And when you add up, the highest score you could possibly get is a 40. And people who get 30 or above on this checklist are considered to be psychopathic. That's the most widely used standard anyway.
I suppose if Kiel does find his data to be accurate in separating psychopaths from non-psychopaths, that there could be some legal ramifications.
Yeah, the checklist, the PCLR, is already used in a lot of different settings in legal systems and corrections systems. So, for example, in parole hearings or sentencing hearings, and to determine what security level different prisoners should be assigned to. And so if he can come up with some neural signature, some pattern of activity or some, you know, structural abnormality in the brain or whatever it might be that turns out to be an even better predictor than the checklist, you know, an even better predictor of whether someone is likely to commit a violent crime or commit another violent crime in the future, then it's possible that it could be used in those sorts of real world settings as well.
Greg Miller, thank you very much.
Thanks, Rob.
Science's Greg Miller on Kent Kiel's work in scanning psychopathic criminals. Read his article in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science news. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to talk about how humans pass on genes for bravery when bravery is more likely to get you killed. We're going to talk about scientific evidence for why we prefer mates that look like our parents. And finally, we're going to explore the potential genetics behind why some men cheat.
Well, let's start with the genetics of bravery. It doesn't seem like that would be a genetic trait that you would pass on.
Right, Rob. Well, when we think about traits that might get passed on, things like perhaps good eyesight or a strong immune system, these are things that it's easy to see how they would be propagated in the gene pool because they confer a selective advantage. But when we think about things like bravery, you know, on the surface, bravery seems like a good thing. But in the context of warfare, and especially in the context of the last several millennia or so, braver individuals are individuals that are more likely to go out into battle and therefore also more likely to get killed. So these researchers wanted to look at the question of why does bravery persist in society if bravery is more likely to get you killed?
Well, how do they go about testing it? I don't imagine that they found a gene for bravery or anything like that.
No, there's no gene that's been identified for bravery. And obviously, you can't throw a bunch of people together and have them fight to the death and monitor it over generations and figure out what's going on genetically. So the best this team could do was a mathematical model that assumed that there was a gene or genes for bravery. And with the model, they were able to simulate a bunch of people basically fighting each other. And some people had this gene for bravery and some people didn't. And they wanted to see what would happen to this hypothetical gene over time.
With the people with the bravery gene getting killed more often.
Exactly. But the researchers also assumed that the people that didn't get killed with the bravery gene also reaped substantial rewards from being brave. That being that if they were part of the conquering tribe, they got to mate with a bunch of the women from the defeated tribe and therefore pass on their bravery genes.
Did they assume that women couldn't be brave?
As far as I know, they didn't look at women in the study. They were just looking at men. But the overall idea is that even though brave people are more likely to get killed, those that survive may reap much more of a reward than those that stay out of battle completely.
And not necessarily by conquering another tribe, but even perhaps for a hero's welcome when they get back home.
Ostensibly.
What are other researchers saying about the implications of this study?
Well, one possibility is that because bravery is persisting in society, if this model is correct and this is how it happens, it may explain why we're still a people that tends to be very inclined towards war. This hasn't been bred out of us genetically because there are evolutionary rewards for being brave.
Well, from finding a brave mate to finding a mate that looks like mom or dad. This is the Oedipus or Electra complex. Aren't we talking about that?
We are talking about that. We're talking about this idea that men tend to choose women who resemble their mothers and women tend to choose men who resemble their fathers. And there's a lot of anecdotal evidence for this, including, as you mentioned, the Electra and the Oedipus stories. And there's been some scientific evidence as well. And in this new study, researchers wanted to see if there was a more systematic way of showing whether this effect actually occurs.
Now, before we get into humans, is there anything like this in animals?
Well, that's where a lot of this science starts, is with a behavior called imprinting. And way back in the 1930s, a researcher showed that if he fed geese as they grew up, the geese began to treat him like their mother. They would follow him around and they effectively treated him like their mother. And since then, imprinting has been shown in other animals. Male lambs raised by goats, for example, grow up as rams that battle for the affection of goats instead of battling for the affection of sheep. So there's evidence in animals that their parents can strongly affect the choices they make throughout life.
So what's the systematic approach for humans?
Well, for humans, this team of researchers was taking this question that had been posed in animals a step further. I mean, we're obviously raised by our parents. How much does how our parents look determine what sort of mates we choose later in life? And their systematic approach here was to look at 312 people from 52 families in Hungary. And they measured all sorts of different characteristics of the parents' and the children's faces. They looked at everything from lip fullness to nose length and even jaw width. And what they found is the men shared a significant number of correlations in these features with the fathers of their mates. And conversely, the women shared a number of these facial correlations with the mothers of their mates.
How are researchers interpreting this from an evolutionary standpoint?
Well, one expert suggests it may be a throwback to the time when multiple hominids lived together, when it wasn't just humans, but other species that were closely related to humans. And in order to make sure that humans mated with other humans, they would look for features in potential mates that reminded them of their parents to make sure that they were mating with the right species. Another idea goes that it's just a good way to find a mate that may share some of the same adaptations that you have, because you would share genetics with your parents, so you'd be looking for a mate with similar genetics as yourself.
Well, from using mom and dad as a guide for choosing a mate, to the genetics behind why men cheat, they actually found a gene for that?
Well, they think they might have. This is a gene called AVPR1A. And basically what it does is it governs the production of vasopressin in the brain. And this is a hormone that has been shown in animals to contribute to attachment behavior with mates and offspring. So it seems like this would be a good gene to focus on. And what they found in animals with this gene, which is kind of fun and surprising, is that if they take a version of this gene that's normally found in monogamous prairie voles, and they put it in promiscuous meadow voles, the meadow voles all of a sudden start acting a lot more monogamous. But the question is, well, does it have any relevance to humans? And so a team of researchers looked at 500 pairs of Swedish twins. They were identical twins, and they looked at this particular gene, and they found that 40% of the individuals they studied contained a specific version of this gene called 334. And they said, is there something about this version that might make people with it more or less likely to cheat, or at least more or less likely to have cheating type behaviors? And the first thing they did was they gave all these subjects a test called the partner bonding scale. And this asked questions like, how often do you kiss your mate? And how often are you and your partner involved in common interest outside the family? So things that would judge sort of how close a couple was. And what they found is that men with two copies of this 334 version of the gene scored significantly lower on this test than men with one copy or no copies of this 334 version of the gene. And so on the surface, that suggests that having this version of the gene makes men more promiscuous, or at least makes them perhaps a less monogamous type partner. But the more striking results came when the researchers asked the men if they had experienced any sort of marital crisis or threat of divorce in the prior year. And more than one-third of men with two copies of this 334 version of the gene answered yes to those questions, whereas only 15% of men who didn't have this version of the gene answered yes to those questions.
Well, that's how the men evaluated their relationships. How did their partners evaluate those relationships?
Their partners evaluated their relationships very similarly to how the men had. So further evidence that there might actually be something real going on here. And what's more, 32% of men with the two 334 versions of the gene were unmarried, versus only 17% of the men who didn't carry this version of the gene. So this was even stronger evidence that there's something about having this 334 version of the gene that seems to make men more promiscuous, or at least have these more promiscuous type behaviors or relationships.
What about in women?
Well, surprisingly, they didn't notice this correlation in women. They didn't notice any link between having this 334 version of the gene and how promiscuous or monogamous women acted. So perhaps there's another gene, or maybe just another version of this gene that's important for women.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
Well, Rob, we're looking into a story about how the strongest tropical cyclones are getting even stronger, how a gene enhancer may have given us our human hands, and finally, how Zen meditation might be better than Prozac. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news site of science. You can catch up on the latest science news at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the September 5th, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.